Here are these few verses from the book of Esther, chapter 4. And they told Mordecai Esther's words, and he had them respond to Esther, "Don't think for one minute, unlike all the other Jews, you'll come out of this alive simply because you're in the palace. In fact, if you don't speak up at this very important time, relief and rescue will appear for the Jews from another place. But you and your family will die. But who knows? Maybe it was for a moment like this that you came to be part of the royal family." Esther sent back these words to Mordecai. "Go and gather all the Jews who are in Susa and tell them to give up eating to help me be brave. They are to eat or drink anything for 3 whole days, and I myself will do the same along with my female servants. Then, even though it's against the law, I will go to the king. And if I am to die, then I will die." These are the words of the Lord for the people of God. Don't think for one minute that you will escape. A month after Hurricane Katrina, on a Saturday, a hot Saturday in late September, we were on the coast of Mississippi engaging with work teams and riding through Pearlington, and found ourselves on a back road outside of Pearlington, which means it was a really back road kind of place. And as we turned and bend in the road, there were some homes, and on these homes that had been obviously flooded a month before, there were 4 elderly people on a porch, and so we stopped. One of the people on the porch, the woman, was waving to us, and I got out of the car and went toward her, and she literally came toward me and wrapped her arms around me and began to weep and said, "Will you listen? Will you listen? Will you listen to what happened to us?" She and the 3 other elderly relatives had been living on the porch of their flooded home. They had not had the capacity, the courage to face what was inside, and so everything inside had been sitting wet and waterlogged for a month in the hot Mississippi sun. And she told me her story as she led me across the yard behind her house to her church. She said, "I have to show you my church. I have to show you my church. I have to tell you what happened to us." She said, "As the water began to rise, we saw it rising in the street, and then it rose in the yard, and then it rose to the porch. And I realized I had to get my husband, my brother-in-law, and my other brother-in-law away because the water was going to rise. One of them was in a wheelchair. One of them had an oxygen tank. They were all elderly." She said, "So I took them one by one over to the church. It's a little higher than our house. And we got into the church, and the water rose, and it kept rising, and it rose up to the steps of the church. And then it began to come in the front door of the church. And I knew I had to get them to a higher place. And the altar was a bit higher. And so we all got on the altar at the front," and she pointed to it. She said, "We got all 4 of us on that altar area." And she said, "The water kept coming, but for some reason, thanks be to God, nobody had nailed that altar down. And so the water began to rise up under the platform," she said. "And the four of us were lifted by the water, inch by inch, foot by foot. And I saw above me the ceiling. And I thought, I've got to get them onto a higher place. And so with my hands, I pulled the ceiling pieces apart, and I helped them get up into the attic. And we were all in the attic. And the water continued to come up, and I thought, oh my God, what will I do if the water doesn't stop? There was no other place to go." And she said, "The water stopped," and she pointed to the very edge of the wall, and you could see the water line. It stopped 6 inches above the ceiling. And she said, "It stopped, and there was calm." And then she said, "The water in time began to go down." And I thought, "How will we'll get back on the altar?" And so they got back on the platform, and the water went down, down, slowly, very slowly, and settled that platform down exactly where it was when the water began to rise. And she said, and then we made our way through all all the rubble, and we've been living on this porch ever since. And she said, but my nephew, and wiped away the tears, she said, my nephew was only 21 years old, and he swam as hard as he could swim through the water, but he couldn't make it to the church. And he was carried away, and he was drowned. Why, she said, why are the four of us, advanced in age, old, she said, why are the four of us still here? And he was swept away. Now, we do not escape in this life the troubles, the overwhelming epics of our time that lift us to the very presence of God. We don't escape the disasters and the trouble. And as we have watched people in Sandy Hook talk about what happened at the school, who among us have not turned away from a TV screen, wiping the tears from our eyes? In this interconnected world in which we live, we are touched by a heartache half a world away, just as we are touched by the heartache in our own communities, in our own families. And who among us this day doesn't bear a heartache for someone in your own family of origin, someone in your own network of very close friends, someone in your church, someone in your community? We do not escape. How wise Mordecai was in his message to Esther. Don't you dare think you're going to escape. You will not escape the pains and heartaches of this world. And then Mordecai said to Esther, God's going to raise up somebody to do something about this. In other words, you don't have to go. God's going to raise up somebody. God is going to raise up somebody. When those waters rose on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi, East Lawn Church in Pascagoula experienced water up to the second level of their Sunday school and fellowship building. After the storm, a year out, my husband and I were there for the rededication, the rebuild of their sanctuary, which was made possible by the generosity of you all and people, United Methodist people across the connection. And we were sitting with one of the trustees, and he told us a pretty amazing story. He said, you know, for months before Hurricane Katrina, we had been working out a church use policy. We had spent hours on this policy. Who could be married in our church? Who could use our church? What should we rent our church? Should we offer it for free? And we had the policy almost finished. And then he said, on August 29th, 2005, we found ourselves, many of us, on the second level of the fellowship building, pulling people in through the windows as they floated by. And we found ourselves calling out in the very limited Spanish that we had, binga aquí, to people who did not speak our language. And 65 people lived in that second level of their fellowship building for months after Hurricane Katrina. And he said, you know, we've never even brought the policy up again. In D'Iberville, Heritage United Methodist Church turned their church outward to all the needs in the community. Many of you have been there and slept on the floor. How many of us have slept at Heritage Church in D'Iberville, Mississippi? Hands all over the room. All over the room. A volunteer said to me, you know, when we came here to work and we gathered for worship on Sunday morning, and saw along the walls of the sanctuary backpacks and toolkits all along the walls of the sanctuary, we thought to ourselves, if we went back home and had sleeping bags and toolboxes in our sanctuary on Sunday morning, it would not be pretty. But they said, because we have engaged this, our church is transformed back where we came from. Back where we came from. Being here has transformed our life as a church. And I don't know where the Mississippi, I see them over here, and Louisiana people are. Where are Louisiana people? Okay, if you ask any Mississippi people over here, ask any of these folks with hands up, who are the strongest churches in southern Mississippi and Louisiana right now, we will tell you that the ones who engaged the disaster recovery, who did not stop when members were taken care of. I wish we could say that all of our churches kept at it. Many of them did. And the ones who engaged this over time are now stronger than they were before the storm. And that's the way God works. An ecologist on Mississippi Public Radio, a month after Hurricane Katrina, observed that all of nature thought that winter had come and gone on August 29th. Because the greenery, the trees, the bushes, the shrubs on the side that the storm blew in from, the damaged side, the unprotected side, was growing back with spring-like foliage. The color was like spring. And the ecologists call this second spring. Now, we call it resurrection. We call it the life that comes out of the engagement with this brokenness in the world. Mordecai said to Esther, "You will not escape, even though you are in the palace. And I'm going to raise up somebody from somewhere," God says. "I'm going to raise up somebody from somewhere." And then Mordecai said to Esther, perhaps, you have come to royal dignity for such a time as this time. This time. Now, in my imagination around this story, I imagine that it was difficult for Mordecai to send that letter. He was not Esther's father. He was her uncle. When her parents died, he had raised her. And when Queen Vashti refused to be a part of a beauty pageant, he was involved in Esther's being brought forth. But at this particular moment, he must have realized that by encouraging her to do this thing, he was asking her to put her life on the line. And who among us here wants to put our child on the line? Now, we don't want to do that. We want to reel them back and keep them safe and perhaps not even tell them about what's happening because we want to protect them from what's happening out there in the world. And imagine how hard it was for Esther to receive this message from her uncle Mordecai, the same one who, after he had encouraged her to be available to the king, to be brought into the palace, Mordecai used to sit by the women's house and look with a worried eye toward it to see if he could see Esther, because he knew the ways of his time. And he knew about the second women's house, the place where women went if they went into the king and then were sent to that house never to be seen again. And so the tie between the two was strong and rich and good. Now, upon receiving the message of her uncle, who in many ways had been her mentor throughout her life, note the first thing that Esther says. "Fast and pray for me so that I may be brave." Her first act was not to say, "Sure, I'm up for it. I'm heading right in there." She said what any sensible human being would say: "Help me. If I'm going to do this, I need a lot of help. You got to help me. You got to help me be brave." How do we do that for one another? This last year, our family was blessed with a new family member, a grandson, Amos, born on June 3rd. And on All Saints Sunday, he was baptized. Mike and I traveled to the church where he was to be baptized. And as we entered this sanctuary, small, maybe 75 people at the most present, the first thing we noticed were banners on every wall between the windows of the sanctuary. And the banners said, "William, I have called you by name and you are mine. John, I have called you by name and you are mine. Tiffany, I've called you by name and you are mine, one by one, all the way around. This not the fellowship hall, not the Sunday school wing, not the children's area, the sanctuary had been given over to blessing those children who had been baptized. And at the front of the sanctuary were four baptismal banners, big ones, yet simple, made out of felt. Amos, I've called you by name and you are mine, the banner for our grandson. And then three other banners for the children who would be baptized that day. And we were surrounded by this sense of God calling each one of us by name. I have called you by name, and you are mine. The banners stay up for the first year after the baptism of a child. And then the congregation brings the child and family forward, and the banner is presented to them, and they take it home, and it's placed in the home of the child. In the child's room. Can you imagine the conversations which ensue about that throughout the days in these families? And as we talked with people afterwards, a woman about my age came up to our daughter-in-law and said, Allison, it was so much fun. It was so much fun. And I could tell they had made the journey together. And she said, wasn't it great having lunch together the day before Amos was born? And I sensed the way this congregation surrounded families who were anticipating the birth of a child. That's what we have to do for our children. That's what we have to do for one another. Remind one another that we are called by name and we are God's for such a time as this. And it's impossible for us to be brave. It's impossible for us to engage the challenges of our time absent that kind of connection and love for one another. Because we are like Esther. If I'm going to do this, y'all got to bless me. You have got to bless me if I'm going in there. I'm about to break the law. I'm about to go to the king, and I cannot go unless you bless me. Will you please bless me? And every one of us have had moments in our lives when we're about to do something, step up to preach, go into a Sunday school class, engage a difficult meeting, and somebody put their hand on our shoulder and said, I bless you. I'm praying for you. I'm with you. Esther was alone, but not alone, because the Jews were fasting and praying for her as she went in to the king. And that's how she was able to say, I will do it. I will do it. I'll go in there. And if I die, I die. In essence, she was saying, it's tough. It's tough. And it may not end up well. This may not end up well at all. A couple years ago in Mississippi, we welcomed the celebration, the commemoration of 50 years since the Freedom Ride, the buses which filled with witnesses for a better, just, inclusive, loving community where everyone counts. And those buses roll from Charlotte to Rock Hill to Birmingham, Anniston, all the way, and they ended in Jackson, Mississippi. And so we had a statewide commemoration of this, and our conference in Mississippi hosted a play called Parchment Letters, a play written and then produced by a group of college students at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And they came down, and we offered this to people across the state. And the first night the Parchment Letters was offered, packed house in Jackson, in a large theater. And at the intermission, someone got up and welcomed one of the Freedom Riders who was present with us. And he stood up, and we greeted him. And then someone else stood up over here, and he said, I was on the bus too. And we said, thank you, and someone else. And then a woman stood up, very petite, Asian in descent, and she stood up and said, I was a Freedom Rider as well. And so we said, well, would you all stay so we could talk with you after the play? And so when the play was over, the Freedom Riders came forward, and we had interaction with them and asked them about their experience and learned from them and grew. But someone was especially attracted to this Asian woman, still very petite, although she's in her 70s. And they said to her, how did you come to be a Freedom Rider? And she said, well, I was 18 years old, and I was a student at Tougaloo College, historically African-American black college in Jackson. And she said, I wanted to do it. I wanted to do what was right. I wanted to be a part of this, she said. And I knew I would be arrested. I was pretty sure I would be, she said. And so she said, when I got up that morning, before I went down to the bus station to greet the Freedom Riders and to identify myself with them, I put on 3 petticoats. Now, a lot of young people were there, and she said, you young people probably don't know what petticoats are, but back in the day, we used to wear petticoats. And I put on 3 of them. I put on 3 of them because I thought if I get arrested and I get sent to Parchman, it's going to be a hard floor, and I'm not going to have a pillow, and I'm going to need a cover. And she said, that's exactly what happened. I was arrested, and I went to Parchman, and the floor was hard, and it was cold. It was actually hot, and I didn't have a pillow. She said, I took off one of the petticoats and lay it down under me, and I rolled up one of the petticoats, and I made a pillow, and with a 3rd petticoat, I covered myself. We are called for such a time as this. I'll go. It may turn out well. It may not. It may not turn out well at all. In fact, in the words of Esther, if I die, I die. This story names each one of us in this moment. Let us bless one another to be brave. We can't do it by ourselves. Let us give thanks that we can't escape this world in which God has placed us. Let us be thankful that as we join hands together, we can be a blessing in every place of trouble. And let's be brave, not because we're brave ourselves, but because God helps us be so. Thanks be to God.